From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And by the end of this week, it became known simply as the speech.
A speech like perhaps no other. Hello again,
everybody. The whole world is going to be talking about this speech most of the day today. And we're going to continue talking about it.
Now people are looking for something more concrete. How he does that, I don't know. I think this is sort of the Mount Everest of speeches.
Wow. It was an important speech, and expectations were high, even as the White House worked to tamp them. Watching the speech itself, you got the sense that every word had a cost-benefit analysis behind it. For example, by saying this...
Unlike Afghanistan, Iraq was a war of choice that provoked strong differences in my country and around the world.
Obama prompted this from Fox and Friends.
And the constant apologizing about America to aggrandize his own sort of cult of personality around the world, I don't think is helpful.
But obviously, it drew a very different response from his audience in the region. For every topic he touched, the Iraq war, the Israeli settlements, nuclear weapons, some were thrilled, others angered. And for still others, the speech was notable for words not said. No mention of the human rights records of the Saudi Arabian or Egyptian regimes. Consider the cost-benefit analysis that went into that. And then there was this.
I know there has been controversy about the promotion of democracy in recent years, and much of this controversy is connected to the war in Iraq. So let me be clear. No system of government can or should be imposed by one nation by any other.
The state media picked on the fact that democracy is a principle that cannot be inflicted by external forces. That was the official media picking up on that.
Naila Hamdi is the chair of the journalism department at the American University in Cairo. She says that in Egypt, the authoritarian grip on the media has begun to loosen, that the government seems increasingly willing to tolerate, within undefined and unpredictable limits, multiple news outlets that readily criticize the regime of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, who some call a dictator. State media, of course, still tout the official line of the Mubarak regime, which is why they focus specifically on the democracy moment in Obama's speech, the underlying message for them being the Mubarak regime is here to stay. The independent and opposition party papers also focused on that moment, but they had a very different take.
Saying what is going to happen with freedom or freedom of expression or other civil liberties, you know, what's going to happen? Has he abandoned us? You know, so I would say that was one issue that was, at least internally here, was really most cited. I mean, not taking away from, you know, the Arab-Palestinian issue, the Iranian issue, but I think the Arab-Middle East conflict, the Iranian conflict, appeared to be more important to the government. Well, internally, everybody's looking more at democracy, more freedom, more development of civil society.
So break it down according to where the particular news outlet stood politically, how it responded to Obama's speech.
If you look at the Ahram, which is the semi-official and most important newspaper associated to the government, the first headline was Mubarak discusses Middle East regional issues with Obama. How Obama says that Mubarak is a man of great experience and is committed to working together to achieve regional ambitions. So you have that. The whole Egyptian media landscape was more positive than anything else. Even the most opposition type of voices took pride in the fact that he decided to speak from Egypt.
As the sage once said, you know, 90% of success in life is just showing up.
Well, I think that he was right. Because, you know, if you look at the headline of Masri Al-Yom, which is an independent newspaper, it actually says Cairo describes Obama's speech to Muslims as fantastic or incredible, whilst the Brotherhood, referring to the Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, and Tehran describe it as words of slogans. I think this is a very indicative headline because they put the Brotherhood in the same basket with Tehran and Iran.
They took the opportunity of Obama's speech and the different reactions to it to lump the politically potent Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt with the incredibly unpopular regime in Iran.
And linking them together was very significant.
The Egyptian government allows opposition newspapers and blogs, but it also jails dissidents and opponents. It's kind of like semi-free speech, isn't it? It's been described to us as almost pre-revolutionary.
The way I view it is that it is moving from an authoritarian media to a more liberal one, but is doing so at a slow pace. So therefore, you find more and more alternate voices, more and more independent media. But every once and again, the government will take sort of crab-like steps and they will maybe harass one blogger or arrest one journalist.
So at the moment, nobody really knows what the rules are.
No, the rules have never been 100% clear, not at the moment or at any other moment.
Naila, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Naila Hamdi is the chair of the Department of Journalism and Mass Communications at the American University in Cairo. Shibli Telhami is the Anwar Sadat Chair for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. For the past 7 years, he's conducted public opinion polls in 6 Arabic countries: Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. This year, he asked more than 4,000 people to tell him, among other things, what they think about President Obama and American policy in the region. Last week, he met with White House officials to share his findings, some of which are reflected in the president's speech. Some of the new findings? 3/4 of those polled still see the U.S. and Israel as the two countries most dangerous to the region. Ending the Iraq War and resolving the Palestinian issue are the two top policy priorities. And, according to the poll, Brand Obama, the president's background, characterized by the emphasis he placed this week on his middle name and his Muslim roots, have caught the region's attention, but not yet sold it on the American brand. Only concrete changes in policy, it seems, can do that. Shibli Telhami joins us from Washington. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
During the election and after, we read all about how Brand Obama, just his name, his Muslim father, his face, and the fact that he was elected here could potentially change attitudes towards Brand America. But clearly this poll does not support that idea.
I don't know why people were assuming that. I think there's no question that people were open to him. It wasn't even the fact that he had roots in Muslim culture. It was more that he was an African, very different from what they have typically assumed would become an American president. But even during the election campaign, April of 2008, I conducted a poll in the Arab world. And while people believe that he is more likely to advance Middle East peace than Hillary Clinton and John McCain, his numbers weren't huge. Only 18% believe he is more likely to advance Middle East peace last year. Hmm. And 13% believe Clinton had a better chance. And a plurality believe that none of the candidates were likely to advance Middle East peace. So they're judging him already on less about who he is and more about what he's been saying and doing.
You say, and I get it, that we have to pay attention to public opinion, even in authoritarian countries. But there's been a lot of dispute whether or not you can really ascertain public opinion in those places, whether the citizens of those countries will actually respond honestly to polls.
That's always a legitimate question. And we always are careful in the way we ask the questions. For example, when I ask a question like, whom among world leaders do you admire most? I ask the question outside your own country. I don't want them to be in a position to have to mention their leaders.
So the Obama administration has sworn in a new Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, Judith McHale. She's responsible for, quote, America's engagement with the people of the world. That's from a State Department release. Mm-hmm. Given the dense web of relationships the U.S. has in the Middle East, what steps do you think she can take to begin to repair that relationship?
One job for public diplomacy is to give advice on how to formulate the policy in a manner that will be heard the way it is intended to be heard. That's number one. Second, I would have her re-examine the role of the American-supported media in the region. There's no indication that this media has been a particularly important arm of public diplomacy in the Middle East.
Remind the listeners what those outlets are.
They're basically the television station, Al Hurra, and it's watched. It has a viewership, but there is no indication it has much impact. I would put a lot of my resources into educational exchanges as much as possible.
Get people over here so they can see what America is.
If you ask the question, have you ever visited the U.S.? Have you ever studied in the U.S.? Have you interacted a lot with Americans? If you said yes to any of these kind of questions, the likelihood that you're going to have a favorable view of the U.S. increases dramatically. This is not because you know America and you love it. That's nonsense. Obviously, America has its good and bad. It is just that if you know America, you see it as a normal place. And most of the attitudes that are so excessively negative are being based on a much narrower prism.
It seems that the less people in the Arab world know about the United States, the more omnipotent they think America is. And that does not redound to our benefit. An alarming number of people still believe that 9/11 couldn't have happened unless we had a part in it.
Conspiracy theories are very prevalent. I see that, by the way, as a function of powerlessness.
And a projection of our ultimate power.
Ultimate power. And if you look at the map, and you look at particularly the Arab Middle East, where you have a lot of authoritarian governments, most of whom are supported by the U.S. government, and you look at the presence of America in the Middle East, talking about the military footprint specifically, it does seem to them to be overwhelming. We're in Iraq in a big way. We're in Kuwait. We're in Bahrain. We're in the United Arab Emirates. We're in Qatar. We're almost every place in the Arab Gulf region. We support Egypt in a big way. We support Jordan in a big way. We support the Palestinian Authority in a big way. We're the biggest backer of Israel. When you look at it from this macro perspective, you can see why people do have the impression that America is dominant in the region.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Shibli Talami is the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He's also a non-resident senior fellow in the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution. This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people. This is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. While the Obama administration is busy rebranding America in the Arab world, a new group of young Arab media stars is working to alter the world's view of Islam. They're sometimes called satellite sheikhs, since their shows are beamed across the region on satellite channels. They're preaching a moderate version of Islam and producing shows that speak to the everyday lives of young people in the Arab world with Western production values. The number of Arab satellite channels devoted to religion has grown from 1 to over 30 in the past 10 years, leaving plenty of room for the big tent teachings of these younger, hipper preachers. Robert Wirth, Middle East correspondent for The New York Times, profiled one of the most popular of these so-called satellite sheikhs, Ahmed al-Shaghari. Wirth says Shaghari's success stems from his talent for relating Islam to the real world.
You know, he'll quote a Quranic passage and say, you know, it's against Islam to waste and not to care for the poor. And then he'll go to some wealthy neighborhood in Jeddah where he lives and show huge amounts of food being tossed into a dumpster or something like that. And then he'll show images of people starving. You know, that's just one example. He'll also talk about incredibly mundane things, which actually I think is one of the wonderful things about his show. So, for instance, he'll talk about sort of the way people park their cars. And he'll say, you know, there's a careless way to do this. And a lot of what he's doing is really sort of basic civics. He's saying, you know, be a responsible person. But he's talking about that in an Islamic language.
What are some of his novel production techniques?
They're a kind of cinema verite type film techniques. Sometimes he's wearing jeans and a t-shirt, but I mean, he looks like an American program in some ways. So he does sort of candid camera type stuff. You know, he'll, for instance, they had in one of the shows, they had, I think it was a man who pretends to accidentally drop a wallet so that you test the reactions of these people. Will they give the wallet back to the old man who dropped it, or will they just take it? So if the guy tries to just take it, they quickly stop him and say, excuse me, that wallet belongs to that guy. But then they say, why didn't you give it back to them? Is that the kind of thing that the Prophet Muhammad would have done?
Kind of like a religious sting, isn't it?
Exactly.
You've written that Shigeri and the other satellite sheiks are getting criticism from both sides. On the right, hardline critics say that he's too Western. Secularists on the left say he could be something like a gateway drug to more extremist Islam?
Sure. Many of the people to whom he's appealing are young, relatively well-off people who would go to college and might adopt a more or less secular worldview, but he's essentially Islamizing them. Now, many of them, of course, if they follow his instructions strictly, they would become moderate Muslims, open to the world, just the way he is. But there are also people who fear that, not because of him, but because of the trend toward extremism across the Arab world, toward Islamism in general, that he may end up becoming a stepping stone. In other words, that once you've adopted a more Islamic way of life, you then become vulnerable to extremists who say, hey, you know, you're on the right path, but you haven't gone far enough yet.
You know, Robert, you know the region and I don't, but I just think that notion of the secularists doesn't make any sense. You think you can box people off from Islam by keeping a moderate sheikh or all of them off the air?
I think you have a point that if you try to sort of appeal to these people with a totally secular point of view, you're probably not going to do very well because it's too late for that. The region has gone through a tremendous religious revival in recent decades, and you got to meet people halfway, and that's where he is.
Do you think that people like Ahmed al-Shigeri can make a difference?
Sure, absolutely. I've talked to a lot of people who watch his show and admire him, who seem to feel that they were faced with a very difficult choice. They felt the world seemed to be divided for them into sort of a really secular path where they felt a bit like they were abandoning their culture and their traditions, or a really hardline, tough Islamist, I hate the West kind of stance. And what they like about him is that he gives them a middle path.
Robert, thank you very much.
Pleasure to be with you.
Robert Wirth is Middle East correspondent for The New York Times. We reached Shigeri in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. The 35-year-old Muslim televangelist told us that he became extremely religious during a 7-year stay in California after, shall we say, a hyper-secular period. He says his message of moderation grew out of the two extremes he lived while in the U.S.
You know, a pleasure-based life, zero spirituality, just living day by day and having fun. And then when I switched to the total opposite, meaning I just cared about spirituality and religion. And I guess the balance is what I believe I reached. Of course, everyone thinks he's balanced at the end of the day. Even extremists describe themselves as being balanced. But I believe now I'm in a balance where religion helps me be a better manager, a better husband, a better student.
When you were in the States, at the time that you decided to become much more religious, you were also watching a lot of television. Can you tell me what the American media taught you, if anything, about what you're doing now?
Yeah, that education, if it's going to be portrayed in media, it has to come within an entertaining format.
How does that play out in the programs that you've done?
It plays out, first of all, to have a short program, because we're talking to an MTV generation. They're used to video clips that end in 5 minutes. I think I heard it, or I read it in one of the American books, that they have the strategy of not focusing more than 20 or 30 seconds on the same frame or something like that. And I'm using that. We don't focus on anything more than 30 seconds. Secondly, it's not just a person talking to camera and preaching. We're using, in a lot of the programs, the candid camera format, which is an American format, to show certain morals. So it's a back and forth, kind of fast pace, 10-minute short, right to the point, no lecture-y attitude.
Tell me what the message is.
The message is live a balanced life. The same message as what Plato, Aristotle, all the philosophers, the prophets said, be good in this life, never hurt anyone, and perfect your work. And eventually this will come back to you as good on earth and after death. There's also one very important topic I always cover, which is respecting other religions and other cultures and opening dialogue with them. and not having me versus the world mentality. I mean, I'm not coming up with something new. It's just I'm packaging it in a way that the youth can accept and understand.
Do you think that there's something missing in the spiritual media diet for young people there, that it's hard for them to relate their religion to the reality of their own lives?
Yes, because some shows that are available are put in a, let me say, boring monologue, one-hour guy talking way. It doesn't capture what they're seeing in other kinds of shows. They're watching American Idol, they're watching Oprah, they're watching all kinds of shows that are just attracting their emotions, and the other programs are not delivering that. So I'm trying to cover that gap. I'm trying to give them something where they can watch and have fun.
You have been referred to in news reports as one of the satellite sheikhs. What do you think of that term?
First of all, I'm not a sheikh. Sheikh is an Arab word that means like a rabbi, a priest. And I always say in my programs that I'm not a scholar and I'm not a sheikh. I'm not a priest. I'm just a simple human being who has hopes for the Arab and Islamic world to improve in all levels, economically, financially, socially. Now, that doesn't necessarily make me a sheikh. It's just a person speaking his mind out.
Do you have to tiptoe around certain issues so as not to upset the authorities or the executives at the satellite channels that broadcast your show?
I don't mention names when I tackle any topic. I do not mention a country, and I don't mention a certain government, and I do not mention names. Therefore, I can get by talking about some taboo topics. So until now, it's been okay. So pray for me, class.
How are you dealing with the fame?
Yeah, dealing with the fame. I'm reading a lot of books on psychology, on how to deal with the fame. I'm not going to deny that I enjoy it. It's a human nature to enjoy acknowledgement and appreciation. However, I'm trying to not make it get to me to the extent that I get used to such a life. Because, you know, things are easy for you. They give you discounts somewhere. If there's no reservation in a restaurant, they let you in. You know, these kind of things. People come up to you and they want pictures. So I'm just trying to enjoy it and not let it get to me.
What show are you working on now?
We're doing the fifth season of the show Khawatir, Reflections, which will air in Ramadan. And interestingly, this season, it will be all from Japan. So we have 30 episodes about the Japanese culture, the Japanese morals and manners, and the Japanese work ethics. And I'm just aiming at showing the Arab world how they are implementing a lot of the things that we're just preaching. For example, we preach in our schools that cleanliness is a major part of the believer. However, you see the streets in the Arab world, a lot of it, it's just a mess because we're not practicing this virtue of cleanliness. I'm showing the Arab world how the Japanese were able to have extremely clean streets and how they are implementing these morals.
You're talking about how these moral prescriptions offered by the Prophet are being carried out in an entirely non-Islamic environment.
Yes, these commandments are universal. So you don't have to believe in Prophet Muhammad to be clean. I'm just trying to make the Arab world feel jealous from the Japanese streets. I mean, I asked the Arab world, if the Prophet Muhammad came today, who will he see implementing his teachings more, the Japanese or the Muslim world? A big question mark. And I say that, by the way, also about the U.S. Most of the prophetic teachings are practiced in the U.S. much more than they are in the Islamic world. Our problem is we focus on two major things, and we just shove everything else aside. We focus on alcohol and sexual issues. So we see the U.S., they're open in these two arenas, so we say we're better than them because we don't have those. However, we forget that these are 2 out of 100. Barack Obama's presidency is a great implementation of a human virtue that Prophet Muhammad and Jesus before him promoted, which is all humans are created equal. When you see an African-American leading the most powerful country in the world out of election, not out of force, and it cannot be implemented anywhere else in the world, anywhere else, this needs to be acknowledged.
Ahmed, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Ahmed Al-Shigari is the host of the program Huwatar, produced in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, and available on satellite throughout the region. The Afghanistan war continues to ebb and flow into Pakistan, the Taliban battling for influence in the Swat Valley and beyond. This means the U.S. military has plenty of work for the foreseeable future. But how much of the battle will be waged with traditional weaponry and how much with PR? The Pentagon's 2008 National Defense Strategy puts it bluntly, quote, "A coordinated effort must be made to improve the joint planning and implementation of strategic communications." Greg Bruno, staff writer for the Council on Foreign Relations, has written about the Pentagon's attempt to counter the Taliban PR strategy. Bruno says it's very tricky because virtually everything the Taliban do is a form of public relations.
The Taliban actually orchestrates its missions with a media strategy in mind. So it might go out and lay a roadside bomb and attack a U.S. convoy. In doing so, it'll bring along a videographer. It'll film it. And within literally 26 minutes, a former official in the Defense Department said they timed it. 26 minutes, this video will be broadcast virally around the world to cell phones in Afghanistan, sent out to broadcast networks such as the BBC. Now, the message that the Taliban seeks to portray with this footage is that the U.S. and coalition forces are unable to protect the Afghan civilians. So, in essence, to frame their message, they're using the media to do so.
And the Taliban began working on their media strategy, you write, in the 1990s. Did they really renovate printing presses?
They did, and they had newspapers, magazines in the local languages, but radio, far and away, is the most effective source of reaching their audience. In the border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan, it's been estimated there are 300 quote-unquote radio mullahs, or Taliban commanders, that have their own radio stations. They, through broadcasting on FM radio, issued dictates on activities deemed un-Islamic. They give information on attacks that they're planning, people that they are planning on beheading. And they also call on their listeners to take up arms against the Pakistani army.
So we know how efficient this Taliban PR campaign is, but do we know how effective it is?
I think that's the big mystery. We don't necessarily know how effective these messages are at recruiting additional fighters or sowing fear. We know that people listen to these radio broadcasts because they're told to, and they have to, and if they don't, they might be killed. So radio is far and away the biggest source of information. In addition, they produce CDs, they have websites, they produce DVDs, newspapers, magazines, you name it. They're quite sophisticated.
In a lot of languages, Dari, Pashto, Arabic, English.
They aren't necessarily just going after the local indigenous populations. Their strategy is global. A lot of their attacks are seen as being orchestrated, not necessarily to sow as much fear in the local populations, but convince the world community that the U.S. and coalition efforts in the region are failing. A couple weeks ago, it was reported through the Wall Street Journal that the U.S. might try to jam Taliban websites. And how did the Taliban respond to that news story? They issued a statement on their website saying, "The Pentagon has tried this before, and it's failed, and it will fail again." This is a statement that was issued on a Taliban website in English.
So it wasn't for the civilian population there to hear.
No, it's for you and I.
President Obama now has ordered the military to rewrite its Information Operations Manual, Field Manual 313, to allow for a faster response to the Taliban's PR maneuvers. What's the big change here?
The name FM3-13 leaves a little to be desired, but it's quite an important document, actually. In the past, a lot of these decisions for who speaks to the media, when press releases are issued, the decisions have been made far away from the battlefield. And the push now is really to get commanders on the ground making these decisions. One potential that's been thrown out there is fitting soldiers with helmet cams, actual cameras that when a soldier goes into battle, they film. And the thinking would be that this could then be put online or put out into the ether to counter any potential message that the Taliban puts out there.
Can America really compete in this information war? One civilian killed is a PR disaster for the American military, and they can't use the same tactics the Taliban use. Does anyone in the know, anyone you talk to, really believe that America can win this message war?
I think it depends on how you define winning. The broader question is how the U.S. and coalition forces back words with action. A U.S. Army commander in Ghazni province, who I spoke to, his example, he's helping Afghans in Ghazni build a hide tanning factory. The big challenge right now is there's no committed funding to these projects. So the U.S. right now is saying, we're here to help you. But when the U.S. leaves, how are these projects going to be paid for? If the U.S. doesn't find a way to bridge the gap, the message of we're here to help you is going to get lost as soon as we leave.
Basically, the American military has to prove that it is a positive and credible force for the reconstruction of that nation.
Exactly. And historically, the U.S. government hasn't been that. We pulled out in the 80s after the Soviets were defeated, and Afghans remember that.
Greg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Greg Bruno is a staff writer at the Council on Foreign Relations. Coming up, fighting the PR war at home with body counts. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, General Stanley A. McChrystal, President Obama's nominee to be commander of American and Allied troops in Afghanistan, testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Tucked into his testimony was this remark about how we ought to measure military success in Afghanistan.
Although I expect stiff fighting ahead, a measure of effectiveness will not be enemy killed. It will be the number of Afghans shielded from violence.
The general's comment seems perhaps at odds with the ongoing PR campaign by the U.S. command in Afghanistan to count and publicize the number of enemy dead. Wall Street Journal reporter Michael Phillips, who broke news about this policy on Monday, says the body counts started to be released regularly in April of 2008 to counter the impression in the U.S. that the war in Afghanistan was being lost. In the first phase of this PR push, the military just publicized the big fights.
The second phase came after an August 2008 fight in Helmand Province in which there were allegations of large-scale civilian casualties. And the president of Afghanistan said the Americans killed 90 civilians. The Americans said, no, we killed many fewer, something like five. In the end, they did a new investigation, and it turned out that the Americans had killed more civilians than they had admitted to and not as many as the Afghans had said. Mm-hmm. The public affairs officers for the military saw this as a real PR disaster for them. They seemed dishonest. They seemed like they were callous towards civilians. And they decided that their approach would be to release as much information about each fight as possible. That includes whether there were civilian casualties or not, but also how many enemy were there and how many were killed.
It does seem, you know, if they've been doing this for 14 months now, 2,000 reported insurgent deaths? I mean, has that had any effect on our perception of the war?
I honestly don't know the answer to that. It's a very good question. Whether the public looks at that and thinks the war is making progress, or if they see those numbers and wonder the next day, well, how come those insurgents are still fighting? That was a problem in Vietnam. The military would report body counts, and they'd be large numbers. You know, the Americans killed 200 Viet Cong today, and the next day there would be another fight. And in 1968, there was the Tet Offensive, which really, I think, shook public confidence in that military reporting.
I'm glad you brought up Vietnam because you wrote that the last time the military made this much effort to count the number of enemy dead was in Vietnam. And that's because, you said, you couldn't measure the progress of the war in territory gained, right?
Exactly. The traditional way that military victory is measured is where does the front line move? If it starts in Normandy and moves its way back towards Berlin, well, then the Allies are winning. If it's going the other way, then the Allies are not winning. And Vietnam threw off that calculation. If the enemy is mixed in with the public, if they're all around you, then moving one block or 1 mile or one village in one direction or another really doesn't tell you much about how the war is going. The way that the military addressed that at the time was counting bodies.
As you've observed, the Europeans really don't like this idea, and the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force, which is made up of U.S. allies, seems to have almost a complete aversion to the idea because of the political issues that body counts raise. And there is also still a large part of the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan that won't report body counts. So dissension even on the ground?
Absolutely. And a number of people feel like counting the number of enemy dead is a mistake. It focuses on the wrong part of a war that's against an insurgency. It's a war for the hearts and the minds of the Afghan people. So if you put out a press release that says, we killed 10 Afghans today, that's really sending the wrong message.
I wonder if there is a better public relations metric out there with which to persuade the American people that the war in Afghanistan is worth fighting. Is there something else out there besides stacking up the enemy dead, you think, that might do the trick?
Well, it's a remarkably difficult thing to measure progress in a counterinsurgency. There are things that the military looks at that can give an indication. For example, school attendance by girls. If girls go to school, particularly in the south of Afghanistan, in safety and get home at the end of the day, well, that's a sign of progress. It might be such things as clinic construction, school construction. That makes a certain amount of sense, but it's hard to present in a news format. You'd read the first story in the newspaper that said American troops built 37 schools, but the second story, which said they built 38 more, you'd kind of roll your eyes and say, well, that's not really news. So it's a hard thing to present those kind of metrics in an enduring kind of way that makes people interested in the war, supportive of the war, and follow it through over the course of a long period of time.
But the military reckons that more enemy dead is always news.
More enemy dead is always news. And I don't know this from any polling, but I suspect that Americans who connect 9/11 to Afghanistan directly look at the war and think, well, we want to kill our enemies, the people who attacked us or the people who are attacking our troops in Afghanistan.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Phillips is a staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Pop quiz. Do you know what the phrase stuck in a groove means? How about drop a dime? What if I quoted a line New York Times columnist David Brooks wrote about Hillary Clinton during the election? To wit, in the first debate, she's Emily Post, now she's Howard Beale. If you got precisely none of those references, chances are you're under 30. And that's a problem, according to Ralph Kies, whose new book is called I Love It When You Talk Retro, Hoochie Coochie, Double Whammy, Drop a Dime, and the Forgotten Origins of American Speech. Journalists, he says, run the risk of alienating potential readers, especially young people and immigrants, when they use retro catchphrases and allude to films from their baby boomer youth. Someone he says has got it bad when it comes to retro speak is MSNBC host Chris Matthews. Here he is, rapping with Pat Buchanan.
Pat, are you going to spend the next 3 years playing St. John the Baptist for Sarah Palin? I mean, you never miss a beat here. You push for her harder than any. What did she do for? I'm sorry, her husband was in the Split from America party with you. Is that what she was, a Pitchfork family or what?
No,
what
Chris,
is the love
Chris,
affair here about?
Your problem is, your problem again is this woman problem you've got, Chris.
Oh, here we go.
Weeks.
Oh. I forgot that you were the new Alan Alda of our times.
Well, I call Chris Matthews the king of retro talk because he is constantly, he's 63, I'm 64, so we're age mates. And he's constantly throwing around phrases like a Perry Como calmness, a Norma Rae America, Borscht Belt, or a Blue Plate special. We often hear people in the media bemoaning, oh my God, younger people don't even watch the news anymore. All they're doing is texting and Twittering. Well, how can we win them back? Well, I don't think using a lot of reference to dated movies and events from the boomer past is a good way to approach them.
You know, Garfield and I were talking about this issue, and it turns out that our kids know all the references to any 70s sitcom that either of us could possibly dole out because of Nick at Night and TV Land. Maybe they don't know the movie references, but the TV ones are a piece of cake.
Yeah, I think I've in the past maybe made a little too much out of TV references, maybe partly because I grew up in Puerto Rico and we had no TV at that time in the 50s.
You know, you've revealed a lot about yourself by saying you grew up without a lot of TV in the 50s in Puerto Rico. I can see the built-up frustration wandering around in a fog of references that you wouldn't understand, hence this book.
Well, Brooke, it's worse than that. I had no idea that my first name had comic overtones until we came back from Puerto Rico to Illinois, and everybody starts saying to me, hey, Ralphie boy, and I had no idea what they were talking about.
Ralph Cramden?
Ralph Cramden.
Now, the point I was trying to make about the television references is that we can draw the conclusion from that little bit of anecdotal experience that the solution probably isn't to shear our language of history, but to make successive generations more familiar with it. If a kid doesn't understand about Nixon's missing 18 minutes, it means that it didn't make it into their history class, and maybe it should have.
Well, my point isn't that these types of allusions where you might expect to have learned them in school are the ones that you need to be concerned about. But I heard John Berman on ABC, news correspondent, made a reference to a Joe Namath-like prediction. I think it was Romney predicting he was going to win the presidential nomination. Okay, he's referring to Super Bowl III, where the Jets beat the Baltimore Colts, big upset. Joe Namath had made a prediction that they were going to win. Joe Namath was the Jets quarterback. Well, people who grew up watching NFL football, as I did in the 60s, got that illusion, but even a lot of fervent sports fans who are younger today, I'm not sure knew what he was talking about.
I'm not a sports fan. I wouldn't have gotten the illusion, though I knew who Joe Namath was. I could have guessed, but even if I didn't, who cares?
Well, there are two issues here, Brooke. I mean, first of all, the issue is, do you get the illusion in the sense of the point being clear? And often you can kind of figure out, as you say, from the context, what point he's trying to make, even if you don't know the exact illusion. But the second point is, are you dating yourself when you use these illusions? Are you as much as saying to your audience, I come from a certain generation. I don't know if people out there who are younger than me get these illusions, and I'm not sure I care.
Has there been any backlash in response to your article?
Boy, did they beat up on me in the comments, the reporters and others writing in and saying, how dare I question their right to use pop culture references. But then it was very interesting. A whole second wave, mostly of bloggers, said, well, wait just a second. You know, when I read newspapers and watch TV shows, I feel like I'm butting in on a boomer conversation, and it doesn't make me feel part of things. So in my estimation, the cavalry came galloping over the hill, to use a retro reference.
But don't you think that the reverse is also true? In fact, isn't it a mark of youth to develop a language that alienates their parents?
Oh, sure. That's what youth is all about. But people who use slang today will pay their dues 20, 30, 40 years from now when they talk to their kids about, well, let's hit the refresh button or OMG or LOL. And their kids look at them like, huh.
Ralph, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke. I've enjoyed it.
Ralph Kies is the author of I Love It When You Talk Retro, Hoochie Coochie Double Whammy, Drop a Dime, and the Forgotten Origins of American Speech. Sasha Frere Jones is the New Yorker's pop critic, and he may be one of those slang-using whippersnappers that Kai's referred to. Of course, in the pages of the magazine, he's a master explainer, charting the currents of pop culture for a broad audience. But when he blogs or twitters, he employs a lexicon that oldsters may find as tough to crack as the Enigma code, along the lines of "Holy Narc Basket on a Wassa Cracker," or "We got caught in that ambient desk jazz traffic jam and then broke up just as Indy got its dance card back." Oh, yeah. But Frere Jones is always mindful of the medium when he chooses his words. For instance, at The New Yorker, he pays attention when the editor raises a question about a given cultural allusion, like the day he was writing about the band Arcade Fire.
And there are several moments in their music where they sound pretty much exactly like Echo and the Bunnymen. And it's not super important, but it felt weird to not mention it. The way it would be strange to talk about, let's say, Lady Gaga and not have a reference to Madonna. So anyway,
and I have no idea who Lady Gaga is.
Well, there, so there you go. You can't win. There was a moment where an editor actually said to the room in general, and people don't generally address everyone in the room at The New Yorker, but he said, "How many people here know Echo and the Bunny Band?" He didn't call them Echo and the Bunny Band. And enough people raised their hands. He said, "Okay, go ahead." But I understood his impulse was like, let's not alienate our readers. And in principle, I agree with him. I've got no stake in dropping a lot of names. Who cares? It's got to make sense. It's got to help you. And in this case, I thought the sound is really there in the voice. It's an unusual male voice. So I thought, you know, I should mention this.
And when conveying something that's art, the first impulse, it seems to me, would be to reach for a metaphor or
sure.
an analogy, and this is precisely where you run up against this reference issue.
Right, I can't say, you know, M is like early Pharoah Monch cut with a little bit of Chino XL. It's not going to help anybody. You're writing hopefully for not just a wide audience, but hopefully in 100 years if somebody comes back and finds this article from the ashes of civilization where it's like Wall-E, and they crush all my work into a little box and somebody decodes it with a new infrared text reader.
And we all know the Wall-E reference.
Wall-E. I just watched Star Wars yesterday with my very sick child, and it's just amazing how Wall-E is R2-D2. Everyone knows. Wait a minute. There we go. Okay, there's a reference. Totally unplanned, I swear to God. But that would be an instance where not mentioning R2-D2 feels like I would not be doing my job.
So we can't wipe out our culture.
We don't want to alienate people. On the other hand, let me not coddle the reader. Like, get up, you know, use the internet. If you don't know what it is, figure out what it is. Bad writing is one thing, but a couple of references you don't know, well, maybe that's how you find out about that thing. Maybe it's that you love George Pelicanos or Richard Price. Well, if there's someone who is just as good as they are and really obscure, well, I'd kind of like to know who that is.
Yeah.
I might want to go to that person. And or if people don't know that George Simenon was one of the first people to write the Policier, okay, if you really love crime novels, maybe you should go check out this French dude. You might like him. You might not.
So you have this voice for The New Yorker, but you
right.
also have a couple of other writing voices. You've kept a personal blog since 2003.
Mm-hmm.
You've started tweeting. And in those outlets, you write in a way that's very different from your New Yorker style. It's dense, to me, with obscure references. Here's a posting from a couple of years ago I think you got a little flack from called "It's Off Tonight." Anyone expecting some kind of "Lyrical gangbangs keep falling on my head" must take a quick sprint around the block, get some Frogurt, and find a new dream. Mr. Warwick's new album is dire boogie makeout piffle, and all Dr. Mr. Dre does is contribute 3 drum loops that I swear come off a sample CD.
I wonder what record I was talking about. Somebody responded to me last night and just said, "I don't get your tweets." And I thought, that's an interesting thing to say because, I mean, with something like Twitter or the web, you know, like a blog, I really do feel like, look, man, you don't have to look at it. And, you know, if it confuses you, stop reading it. Unfollow. Do whatever you want to do. It's fine. I'm not offended. Because I'm interested in what these things do, almost like instruments, which sounds a little bit corny, but...
You mean this new technology?
Yeah, I want to see what they do. The only way I'm able to figure out what they do is by using them. The web uses links intensely, which you can't do in print. You've got images. Twitter has this built-in limit, which affects the voice in an interesting way. Why not take it for a spin? I'm not going to get anywhere with my writing. It's not going to help me if I'm duplicating something I'm doing during the day. If I'm not letting the technology take me somewhere, then why am I using it?
But getting back to your paid gig, has there ever been a moment then where a cultural or a musical reference or a historical reference that is exactly right, it should be there, you had to leave on the floor and it still bothers you?
No. I hope I don't lean on them too much. Well, language, that's a whole different thing. There are times when I might want to be more figurative or metaphorical, or I might want to use a certain rhythm or a certain joke. You often think, boy, that was funny. And the editor usually, who's on the side of reason, says, yeah, it's just confusing. And, you know, you go home all rack 'em. And the next day you realize, wow, that was, I'm glad we didn't use that one.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Sasha Frere Jones is The New Yorker's pop music critic. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Buolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Ethan Scheel and Cara Gianfrido. This is Cara's last week with us, so thank you for everything and good luck. OTM is edited by me. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Catcher Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer, bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.